One good thing about the Salafi school of the 90s and 2000s was that the Aqidah books you guys are reading are human developments. Understanding Wittgenstein's theory on language will actually help you understand the Sifat controversy. The problem is not the critique. The problem is the critique is lax adab, and it goes from, okay, he's wrong to he's a kafir and he's a CIA agent. That's the problem, right?
How many fights do you want to pick today, man?
Forget me. Go listen to these other three guys.
We were talking about this in the car as well. You famously kind of moved away from a passionately held worldview that you used to have. To a different kind of, someone could say a different worldview, and it was quite public about it. Some of the criticism that you might get from people is, you know, people like that, they're just kind of flip-flopping around, they're going to keep changing their worldviews. And so my question is, will you ever go back to Windows?
No, never.
Okay.
I have repented.
Yeah.
And there is no going mashallah. Back.
Mashallah, mashallah. But in
nice one.
In a serious note, we've been kind of following, obviously, your discourse and some of your writings and your lectures and stuff. The last time we spoke was a good few years ago,
yeah.
All three of us. But since then, I've noticed you've been, mashallah, doing lots of great work in terms of reaching out to different scholars. You spoke at, alongside different scholars from different backgrounds, Ash'ari, Athari, and Maturidi, and so forth. But one thing that I noticed and we spoke about briefly was you say that you don't take a position in that traditional historical kind of
classification
of Ahlul Sunnah, but you say they're all correct, we should all get along. Why that ambiguity is something some people might be questioning.
Jay, so this is a deep question. I will ask you to allow me to elaborate a little bit on that. And also, quick disclaimer that you've asked a bit of a technical question. So if our viewers are not aware of any backgrounds of this nature, then this probably is not a useful conversation for them. The disclaimer is this is an advanced topic. That's what I'm trying to say. So let me answer at different tiers as well, because it is an advanced topic. Mm-hmm. At level one, I would say to the average Muslim that comes to me, if he were to or she were to ask me which school should I follow, I would say whichever of the mainstream schools that you find comfort in, whichever of the mainstream schools makes you feel the most love of Allah and His Messenger, fi kullin khair. That would be my generic advice. Whether you go to a Deobandi, a Tablighi, a Salafi, a Ash'ari, moderate Sufi, the mainstream I'm talking about. I'm not talking about the whirling dervishes. I'm not talking about, be sensible here. I'm talking about the ones that we know, the ones that we're aware of and interacting with, Jamaat-e-Islami. Like, these are the main Ahli Hadith. Fi kullin khair. They're all good. I'm not saying they're all equally the same. I'm saying fi kullin khair. Okay, this is at the level one. Okay. The level two would be that what if somebody goes like, okay, but I've studied all of them and I kind of sort of see that there's good in all. So now we're talking about somebody a little bit more muthaqqaf, a little bit more, understanding. And now he wants to know, but I want to study a book of aqidah. I want to be involved for a few years in a madrasa. Should I go to Jama Islamiyah or should I go to, Al-Azhar, or should I go to, Malaysia, or should I go to Timbuktu? All of these are different strands. Now he knows a little bit and he's interested in pursuing. To that person, I would say, understand what you're getting into in all of these and go to the one that is the most conducive to multiple factors, logistics, family, finances, the level of education. Don't base the primary factor on the version of aqidah. I would literally say this. That is a factor. If you already understand these different schools to a good degree, and now you want to further your Islamic studies, then look at a whole bunch of factors. Political safety. Literally, you don't want to go to a place that there's going to be a civil war in a few years in Allah Mustan, Look at a bunch of factors and then go there and absorb all they have to teach you, but with an open mind. Meaning, understand, had you gone to another university, another institute, you would have been exposed to an alternative that has completely proved itself internally, just like your current system is internally consistent. So go there with an open mind. Understand that this is a great interpretation, a great understanding, and alhamdulillah, there are other understandings out there. This is level two, okay?
Does someone need to get into that though? Even level one, you describe as some, okay, choose whichever one you feel.
Well, yeah, because
does someone need any, do you need?
By need, do you mean salvation? No.
Yeah.
But by need, do you mean like to fulfill intellectual curiosity? Yes. Because if somebody is interested in, well, what is fiqh? What is aqidah? The complete layperson. Mm-hmm. You're like, just go to your local masjid and study. That's what I would say. Go to the one that you feel the most comforted in.
Accessibility.
Accessibility, yeah. But it's not needed for salvation.
We need some instruction or recommendation to the person teaching that person then.
Who am I to instruct the third person? I mean, the person is coming to me and wanting to be told, because again, the way the world works, they want these simplistic answers, mm-hmm. and I'm not like that anymore.
Maybe we need to provide that to them in a
so then you might become a part of the problem. Because my goal by saying what I say, mm-hmm. my goal is to put that kernel of open-mindedness even in this person here. Mm-hmm. My goal is that this person, inshallah, they will understand that actually in this particular field I have studied, and perhaps I am an expert, and yet still I'm saying, you know, fi kullin khair. Maybe that little idea is going to resonate with them for years to come. So that's level two I explained now.
Okay.
Level three is now the more, if you like, complex one. Level two is basically like you go, you study, you take a tradition, you come back knowing your own tradition and understanding that there are other traditions that are just as internally cohesive and just as internally validating as your own. So don't take them as the enemy. You do you and let them do others, and we have bigger fights to fight. However, the problem with level two still remains, and that is that at level two, the average graduate who hasn't really critically thought still internally believes, and that's what he will have been taught, that my paradigm is the best paradigm. In fact, it is the only authentic paradigm. And all of the other paradigms, okay, I don't doubt their sincerity, but they're wrong. In fact, they're misguided about aspects of theology. In fact, if depending on which school you go to, they're actually mubtadir.
Is this widespread? Okay. This feeling?
If you go to any reputable mainstream seminary, yes. Because that's the whole point. You are taught this is the particular aqidah, this is the particular manhaj that we're going to follow, this is the best way of doing fiqh. And anybody who goes beyond this, and these are all mainstream, those who go beyond them, anybody who goes beyond this, accusations of misguidance, tabdi' and heresy come.
The natural consequences of those views, is it said or unsaid?
Depends again on which seminary and which era. I caught the version of my institute in the 90s in which it was very clearly said.
Yeah.
It was explicit from top to bottom. I believe that they have changed that a little bit, but you can't get away from it, because in the end of the day, if you believe that this particular interpretation of Islam is valid, then automatically it would imply the others are invalid. Okay? So at some level, there will be this. So what happens, the average graduate comes back believing deep down inside that, yeah, my tradition is the best, and these other guys, you know, they kind of messed up along the way, but you know what? We're just going to have to get along with them because we have bigger battles to fight. And this is how I was when I returned from my institute, 2005.
Yeah.
It's exactly how I was. My way is the only way.
19 years ago.
I know that the other ways are wrong.
Yeah.
But for the maslaha of the ummah, I will come and cooperate with them.
Did you feel that in fiqh as well?
Fiqh was never an issue for me, because the institute that I studied with always emphasized comparative fiqh. So for me...
So from day one they gave you Bidayat al-Mujtahid or something?
Yeah, no, that was the book. Not day one, that was... You're trying to make a joke of it. It was my book.
Yeah.
I studied Bidayat al-Mujtahid pretty much cover to cover. That was the book I studied. we didn't do madhab based fiqh.
Is there something in that where that led to you being a bit more relaxed when it comes to ta'assub with madhab?
Yes, yes.
Can you see something like that in aqidah now?
No, that's not happening in aqidah. This is where the line is drawn.
Something that could happen in aqidah.
That's what I'm trying to do. That's what I'm getting
is
to come
into.
That's point three now. Okay. That's what I'm trying to do here. So one good thing about the Salafi school of the 90s and 2000s was that it really did teach us that fiqh is a human development, and that Allah's sharia is distinct from human fiqh. This is an amazing thing that they actually taught us, that we understood the madhahib are attempts. Now, to do so, of course, they opened up a Pandora's box, and that Pandora's box is do-it-yourself fiqh, that Pandora's box is you don't have a consistent usul, that Pandora's box is vahiri, like, you know, literalism. Yeah. So there are negatives that come with that type of opening up as well. Yes. But the thing is that the average well-grounded Salafi student of knowledge will inherently be more open-minded to fiqh differences.
Really?
The average open-minded Salafi student of knowledge, not some strands of Salafism.
Okay.
Like the strands that study fiqh, you're talking about one Jordanian strand, that's something else. But mainstream yani Salafi fiqh, like they will understand that, okay, it's not that big of a deal. Even if you say this, it's not a matter of bid'ah or whatnot, it's not that big of a deal. Of course, aqidah, there is no compromise in aqidah. Okay, that's taught by all of the schools. This is level two. My point with level two would be, if you get to that level where you're going to work with others for the pragmatic good, that is good enough. But still, there's a cognitive dissonance.
Something in your heart that...
There's something in your heart.
It's going to angst. It's going to create.
And it's not healthy for the ummah.
Yeah.
I was that person from 2005. I mean, even before, but I mean, my active da'wah 2005 up until around 2015. When I just, it did not make sense to me. It just did not make sense to me.
Yeah.
These are not evil people. And of course, the worldview I held, we were not just accusing them of bid'ah, we were accusing them of shirk. If you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, of course.
And for those who don't understand, you can listen to my library chats. I have them very clear. I've been very open about this, right? Yeah. We were accusing them of shirk. How do you compromise on somebody whom you're accusing of committing shirk? And this is my cognitive dissonance, like this doesn't, and then I know these people, I'm interacting with them, these people are more pious than I am, their tahajjud is better than mine, their actual love of Allah and His Messenger is shining through. I don't see any shirk from them. Mm. You know, when you, what your teachers say in a closed room when it's only your group, that's just your own, you know, internal box that you're, but when you actually go and interact with them, you see a different side of things.
Yeah.
And it became clear to me that it's not that simple. But I couldn't understand why it's not shirk. This is, again, 15 years ago. Because the what I've 7, 6, 7, 8, because what I had been taught, to me, it seemed as simple as 1 + 1 = 2.
Yeah.
My version of Islam was solid. Like, this is shirk. This is exactly the Quranic shirk. How come these guys don't see it? How come they don't see what I'm seeing? This is what led me to study for a few years directly from their books and ask their scholars very deep and probing questions. An open mind. And the difference was the open mind. Because when you go with blinders, when you go wanting to critique, when you go with the mindset of...
You're going to find whatever you're looking for.
Of, you know, finding faults. Mm. You're going to find what you want to find. I went with the mindset of, I don't think I've understood these guys. Not with the mindset, I want to become them. With the mindset of, clearly, I haven't understood what's going on here.
I think they call it empathic listening.
Empathic in understanding and listening, yeah. So that was the mindset that I had. And of course, you know, my master's and PhD is all in Islamic theology, development Islamic theology. This is when, of course, a number of years, it came to the conclusions I came to are a little bit technical. And this is where it gets awkward because now the critics just jump up for the 30 seconds because it's difficult to elaborate. And I understand, but I will try to elaborate in a nutshell. The conclusions that... I have come to are that all of these strands of theology are human attempts shaped by, frankly, cultural and socio-political factors to answer questions that troubled the minds of generations long gone. And I've tried to explain this in my library chats about the attributes of God controversy. Islamic theology is obsessed with the attributes of God. All firq, the Ibadiyya, the Zaydiyya, the Mu'tazila, the Asha'ira, the Maturidiyya, before them the Kullabiyya, you know, before them the every single group, the Karamiyya, the groups that are not even in existence. Maybe 30% or 40% of any textbook of Aqidah discusses God's attributes. Okay? And when you're introduced to your firqa or even the other firq, you don't even think why. Okay, this is Aqidah. But the third level, the three dimension, the higher level is like, hold on, why are we obsessed with aqidah when it comes to sifat? Why is the sifat an aqidah question?
Yeah.
The sahaba never debated sifat.
Mm-hmm.
When you go in, and I've done my library chats, when the Muslims entered Damascus for the first time, and Aqidah was a clean slate. There was no writing on the wall. There was no table of contents, right? They came across Christians arguing over the nature of God and the nature of God's attributes and how Jesus and God are interconnected or not, and how is the Logos, and is the Logos created or the Logos separate or the Logos is God. This is well known. And when they found all of this controversy and their slates are blank, it's human nature, that controversy is going to get a whiff onto our slates. And so
it's just like today with other things like culture LGBT, wars, everything, or feminism, everything, yeah. Red
but
pill
the difference that. Is that there was a clean slate back then. So on a blank slate, the first domino then becomes the sifat controversy. So rather than saying, is Jesus nature one? Is Jesus part of God? It became, are the sifat of Allah one? Or the sifat muta'addida? Are the sifat this and that, right? And then, is the Logos created or uncreated? Oh, what is Logos? Kalam. Is the Kalam Allah makhluq ghir makhluq? You literally copy and paste. And then I mentioned John of Damascus. Go listen to my library channel. The origin of the John of Damascus's analysis becomes the beginning of i'tizal. Literally, the early Mu'tazila are copying and pasting John of Damascus. That's where Mu'tazilism begins. Then as a reaction, the Atharis come along, the proto-Atharis, the proto-Sunnis, and say, no. Actually, Allah has a yad that is actually a yad. And we believe in an actual yad. The Sahaba didn't say like this. I'm not saying they didn't believe it. Because what the Sahaba believed is a back projection of later groups onto them. We don't know what they actually believed, right? We really don't know. We're just assuming. My point is that the 3D analysis, the deeper analysis, you understand the entire Sifat controversy is a contrived one as a response to a socio-cultural phenomenon that took place at a certain period in time. Allah did not reveal the Sifat controversy. The Sahaba were not involved in the Sifat controversy. So once you understand the origin, number one. Number two, you understand we have the benefit of hindsight that they did not have. This is a key point. We have 13 centuries of looking at what actually happened because of the Sifat controversies. Whereas the founders of these movements and the icons, Ibn Taymiyyah and Ghazali and Al-Razi, did not have what we have. This is not to say we're better than them. Because again, the critics come and say, oh, so you think you are? No, we are standing on the shoulders of giants. But here's the point. Because we're standing on their shoulders, because of their shoulders, we see what they cannot see. Doesn't make us better than them. It's just that they paved the way. They did so much. Now we have the opportunity to look back. And what does this show us? These 13 centuries of debates, what did we gain by them? It's awkward to say this. It's like the kid who cried out, you know, the emperor is no clothes, if you know the parable here. But the reality is, all of these strands were bickering and fighting over semantics. That's just a fact. Those who affirmed Allah comes down, istawa, or yanzil, haqiqatan, versus those who said, yanzil is a metaphor. They're both praying tahajjud to Allah.
Yeah.
In the last of the night.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Those who said, Allah is yasma' bisam'in huwa hu, wala ilaysa hu, wala, and basically they're trying to make ta'wil of sam' of Allah, which is the Mu'tazila, right? And the Ash'ara said this, and the Maturidi said this, and the Athari said this. In the end of the day, all of them, including the Mu'tazila, they're raising their hands to Allah when their son is sick and they're saying, Ya Shafi, cure my son. It's just how you're phrasing. It's just a matter of philosophy of language. That's how it is, right?
But there's a qualitative, there's a difference between that, completely with you there. But when you started this convo, when it comes to Tawheed and Shirk, in terms of somebody saying, oh, so-and-so, oh, you know, be this and that, or saint so-and-so.
Even this goes back to an understanding of what exactly is intended and what defines a god.
But do you see that as a
separate controversy. No, it's a separate controversy to this one. I'm giving the Sifat one. And what you're talking about is a distinct controversy, which is not directly related to Sifat. The claim is made that it is related, but it is not related.
But
the
wait,
claim
does is it made. Map onto the schools historically?
Not the early schools, no. Okay. This controversy is coming after the 7th, 6th, 7th century. Whereas the controversy of the Sifat is from the 2nd to the 5th century, the formations are done. Yeah. Okay, so... And this is what I love to do. My actual passion and forte, my PhD, my academic research that I do at the advanced level is the development of ideas, develop Islamic theology. That's what I love to do. Okay, political history, military history that comes on the side. The real history that I write papers on, I've published papers on, my dissertations on, is, and my library chats, is ideas of aqidah. So once you understand that it sounds sacrilegious to the average student of knowledge, the aqidah books you guys are reading are human developments.
Yeah.
Trying to solve problems that are relevant to certain eras and epochs. All of a sudden then, we have to ask ourselves, do I need to teach my kids the sifat controversy? Do I need to brainwash and indoctrinate them with one school versus the other? Do I need to replicate the hatred that existed in 3rd century Baghdad? Maybe even legit, because they didn't understand the repercussions. I'm not even blaming them. I'm not even faulting them. But we have 13 centuries. And again, Allah protect us all. I mean, may Allah protect. I don't like the cancel culture. I don't like the refutation culture. And I always have to feel, you know, make these caveats here. May the intelligent people understand what I'm saying here. The Ibadis of Oman are Mu'tazili in creed.
Yeah.
Their worship of Allah is no less. Frankly, it is better than most Sunni lands. Frankly, if you've ever visited Oman.
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Their akhlaq, their tahajjud, their Quran, their strong iman. I know the critics are going to go absolutely crazy with this. I'm not saying Mu'tazilism is correct, but I'm saying the way you guys made it out to be the brother of shaitan, no, it's not.
I think partly...
So let me finish this one point. Yeah. So the accusation that if you say X, this will imply Y, that syllogism is a figment of the imagination of the critic. If you deny Allah's istiwa, then it's going to happen. Well, this then is from you, not from the people themselves. The people who actually hold it, don't go there. And this is what I'm saying when I say we have the hindsight of history. 13 centuries, we look back. The Zaydis of Yemen are Mu'tazili. They're praying tahajjud and doing everything as well. You know what I'm saying? They clearly, the I'tizal, they believe, the Ibadis believe the Quran is makhluq. The Ibadis believe the Quran is makhluq. Their Grand Mufti is on YouTube, literally defending and then saying, but Sunnis, he literally said, but Sunnis, you guys made this a bigger issue than it needed to be. We still recite the Quran, take the Sharia. That's his view. I'm not saying I agree with it, right?
Yeah.
And look at their laws and look at the people. So what I'm saying is, firstly, the origin of the controversy. Secondly, the hindsight that we now have, okay? And then thirdly, at a deeper level, we have access to various disciplines of knowledge that earlier scholars did not have that we can employ as tools to better understand. And of them is the philosophy of language.
Yeah.
For example, with the Sifat controversy, we now understand the usage of language, the functionality of language. Yes, true, Ibn Taymiyyah, mashallah, tabarakallah, he did contribute, you know, a little bit in the nominalism and great. But the level we now have, because that's what the modern world has done, it really has gone to a level of ilm that is unprecedented in human history. And frankly, I mean, understanding Wittgenstein's theory on language will actually help you understand the Sifat controversy to the point of it making a non-controversy. You can literally take Wittgenstein's theories of language, look at the Sifat controversy, and collapse it all and say, well, actually, there is no controversy.
Have you thought about writing about that?
I have, but again, time is always precious. Mm-hmm. My problem is I'm spread so thin in different ways. So to finish this off, so then you look at the origin, you look at hindsight, and then you look at ulum that we now have that they didn't have.
Yeah.
Put all together, and you start to realize much of what we took as being important was actually superfluous. We don't need the Sifat controversy to be good Muslims. Mm-hmm. And if you are an Ash'ari or Maturidi or Mu'tazili, I know this is going to get me cancelled immediately in the Sifat issue, because the Mu'tazila, here's the point, the Mu'tazila, the main issue with us and them is Qadr.
Yeah.
I say, and I will say this, may Allah protect me from, the problem is not the critique, the problem is the critique is lax adab, and it goes from, okay, he's wrong, to he's a kafir and he's a CIA agent. That's the problem, right? The problem is like, he's wrong. Fine, I know you're going to follow mainstream Sunni, thought you're going to say I'm wrong, I get it. But don't make it bigger than it is, okay? I am saying, the modern Ibadi movement has issues, but Sifat is not one of them that's going to cause any issues between us and them. They're good people in the end of the day. We see this, Ra'ya al-Ain. So we learn from all three of these issues, the origin, the history, and the ulum that we now have that we can look back to, that the Sifat controversy was completely blown out of proportion, and it, you don't need it to be a good Muslim. So when you ask me, what are you, Ash'ari, Maturidi, Mu'tazili, you know, Athari or whatnot, you understand I don't believe in these boxes anymore because I understand where the controversy came from. And I empathize, I know this sounds weird, with all of them.
Yeah.
I genuinely see where they're coming from. And I don't think any one of them is divine. They're all human attempts to answer questions that were problems of their time. It's a historical controversy. I like studying it. I don't find myself having to carry a card about one of these past issues.
So on the Sheikh, look, so there's three options for the general population now. Is it one that we minimize the engagement with understanding Aqidah in those classical boxes as one option? Number two, we deconstruct it to then just educate people. Or three, should we use a blank slate and relook at Aqidah for modernity?
Excellent question. And that is a very profound question, Mr. Omar Suleiman. I love it. Number one, should we?
Yeah. Minimize.
So profound, you forgot the question.
We should minimize the controversy at the level of the masses.
Yeah.
This is what I've done. On a personal note, I was obsessed with the sifat controversy. I mastered it. Literally, my master's was on the sifat.
Yeah.
My master's published in Medina, 800 pages. Go look it up. Jahab ibn Safwan and his, you know, it's all sifat. 800 pages of master's, alhamdulillah. And I'm not trying to brag about stuff for Allah, but it was awarded and it was and it published and it was like number one in my class. It's there, you can read it. And I came back to this country literally yaqeen that the sifat, as understood by Ibn Taymiyyah and his group, is the correct understanding of Allah. There is no question in my mind that all the others are batil or whatnot. But again, that's your one-dimensional view. You start doing 2 and 3D view and all of a sudden you understand, okay, Ibn Taymiyyah is right, but he's not necessarily only right. Ash'ari are also right in their way, and Mu'tazila are also right in their way. It all goes back to your paradigm, right? So I stopped talking about these controversies at the mass level completely. Look at my khutab and durus.
Yeah, yeah.
Ignored completely. Mm-hmm. Recently, there was a massive debacle between the Ash'aris and Salafis online, and I got angry at both sides. I reached out on behind the scenes because I'm not on social media. I reached out to people on both sides. Akhi, taqila, there's a genocide going on. Leave these issues. So at the mass level, yes, completely bypass. Your second question, should they be taught with wisdom? They should be taught at this madrasa level. Yes, because you can't reinvent the wheel. So when you go to a higher seminary, when you go to any mainstream school, understandably, the school has to teach you 1,400 years of history, intellectual history. And understandably, you're not going to get rid of the schools. I'm not challenging Ash'arism, Atharism, Salafism. I keep on saying I moved on. I've always used this term. Yeah. I didn't switch sides. Moved on, I've been very precise because I no longer view these schools as being divine. I really don't. Allah didn't reveal Salafism, nor did He reveal Ash'arism. I can show you human elements. I can show you evolution in all of these schools. I can show you spectrums within them. When you tell me, be a Salafi, I will say, which version? Abu Ya'la's version? Or Ibn Aqil's version? Or Ibn al-Jawzi's version? Or Ibn Taymiyyah's version?
Yeah, that one.
If you tell, that one, okay. If you tell me, and even Ibn Taymiyyah, who's going to interpret Ibn Taymiyyah? Because after Ibn Taymiyyah, there's no traditions, right? The same with the Ash'aris. Which version of Ash'arism? Ghazalian version? Razian version? Which version? Again, I can show you evolution. I can show you spectrum. I can show
but
you...
But I think part of... I sense that none of you, what you said is that weird. You keep saying that, oh, this is going to get me cancelled or whatever. I think the reason why you feel that way is because you dedicated so much research and learning and you're seeing that because from your expertise, from your background, when it comes to the average.
Oh, what I'm saying, the average layman will understand 100%.
Not the layman, even Tulab Ilm, even people that delve in these books.
I think you give them more credit than I do, then I'll be honest with you. Because for most people, the tradition that they subscribe to is the religion of Islam.
But I think what you're maybe subconsciously you're bringing a lot of your own expertise and your own background, your own baggage maybe. And you, when you see a Salafi,
but look at what's happening
Ash'ari
over the last few weeks online between people that are worthy of respect, mainstream Western clerics battling it out while bombs are dropping in Gaza over does Allah have a hand or not. Or does Allah have istawa or not?
I haven't been watching.
Okay, the massive debate is taking place right now, as we speak. Still, it's still going on right now. And these are mainstream shuyukh, not little kids. These are people of with respect. And they are...
I'm not saying there aren't people who are still...
But these are icons.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. So I think there are always going to be people like this. So, and then your third point, deconstruction. That's what I'm doing at the advanced level, which is my library chats, which is the Islamic Seminary in America, where I teach the students. In order to get to that level, you need to have a background. It cannot be done just as a public lecture.
The final level was re-looking at aqidah in life.
I'm getting there. So deconstruction is taking place, and it's taking place, and I encourage everybody who has a solid background and who is resonating with aspects of what I'm saying. I say this to anybody who says, I want to study with the Islamic Seminary. I say, listen to my library chats. If you find my library chats appealing to you, these are tidbits of the real philosophy of the seminary. Go ahead and apply, and it is an accredited seminary. You're going to get a master's degree that is accredited by the Western world. So apply to that, because that's where we go into that level of thinking. Okay, that's level three. Level four then, which is when you ask me, which class was I the most excited to teach?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's level four.
Yeah.
That is, what does modern aqidah look like? I don't care about the sifat. We all have teenage kids. None of them are debating about the sifat.
I know somebody's going to take that little clip.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't care about the sifat controversy.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course,
of course the sifat
I'm
of
looking
Allah.
Out for your best interest.
Thank you, even though... It doesn't matter. If I say the sky is blue, they're going to come and say whatever it is.
You deny it can be any other color.
Yeah. Allah mustan.
Yeah.
I'm a firm believer, as Allah says in the Quran, that which is done... Yani, for the sake of Allah will remain, and that which is done for others will be gone. فَأَمَّا الزَّبَدُ فَيَذْهَبُ جُفَاءً وَأَمَّا مَا يَنْفَعُ النَّاسَ فَيَمْكُثُ فِي الْأَرْضِ. So my goal is sincerity and ikhlas and hidayah. And jokes aside, all of the criticism will not even be in the footnotes of the books of history. If what we're doing is for the sake of Allah, it will remain as a legacy. Look at the critics of, I mentioned this, even Umar Mukhtar, Ibn Taymiyyah, whatnot. Look, where are they now?
And the only reason you know about them is because of those
exactly.
people.
So yes, it is painful now, and it is causing drama amongst the masses now, but it's not ilm, and it's not of benefit, and it's just, you know, passing. So the long term. So my point, therefore, is that what will modern Islamic theology look like? And you know what it's going to look like? We take our teenagers, and we just have them in a room while we're sitting there taking notes.
Blank slate.
And see exactly... What are the questions they're asking? What are the issues that are troubling them? And then we look at that and start formulating Islamic responses. This is what needs to be done. Hardly anybody, I would say nobody's done it the way I like it to be done. It is one of the projects. You asked me, do I have any project? This is one of the projects I have, inshallah. Time is an issue, but wallahi, one of my biggest passions right now. And I say this to my because I still have a massive soft spot for the Salafis, for Ibn Taymiyyah. Come on, Ibn Taymiyyah, you can't help but admire him. And one of the biggest things I admire about him is the courage, the fearlessness. He really did not care about popularity. His views were so eccentric. Salafis don't realize that. Salafis who love him don't realize he came with a whole bunch of shad views, fiqhi-wise and aqidah-wise. But he didn't care because he felt it was the haqq. And guess what? Those shad views became mainstream Salafism today. Literally. I know it sounds blasphemous to the Salafis, but it's true. Modern Salafism has so many views that are absolutely unprecedented pre-Ibn Taymiyyah. I don't want to get to it because it's a whole different. I have an article that I'm writing about you know, Ibn Taymiyyah's contributions to the Salafi da'wah. Meaning pre-Ibn Taymiyyah, athadism was very different. Salafism were different, right? The main was Ibn Taymiyyah introduced the categorization of rububiyyah and uluhiyyah into Salafism. Yes, one or two people referenced some concept, but nobody took it mainstream and nobody interpreted it the way Ibn Taymiyyah did. Nobody brought this notion of, okay, you can believe in God but worship other than God and not call him a God.
Yeah.
That is uniquely Taymiyyan, to differentiate between rububiyyah and uluhiyyah as a practical mechanism to pronounce verdicts on actions. Yes, I know Ibn Manda and Fulan, two people, had, you know, statements where you kind of sort of see a distinction in a categorization. They didn't do anything with that categorization. And that's why you're getting into a lot of trouble here. Imam Ahmad would allow tawassul. Imam Ahmad would allow tabarruk. The Hanabila were well known to be mutasawwifa. They didn't have an issue with this regard. Look at Abdul Qadir al-Jilani and the stuff that he would do, right? Ibn Taymiyyah comes along, the first person in human history history to say you cannot travel to the qabr of the Prophet with the intention of visiting grave. That becomes a bid'ah and a stepping stone to shirk. Again, I respect Ibn Taymiyyah immensely, but I challenge you to find me based upon his distinction of ubudi rubiyya. There are some that had other reasons, but yeah. Ibn Taymiyyah is coming from a specific theological paradigm. Okay? Anyway, you got me into a lot of trouble there. So my point is that Ibn Taymiyyah redefined Salafism completely with Shadh, unknown views, he brought them in. They're now mainstream. It is a fact. Take it
or leave it. But those views, qualitatively, they seem to be more about classification, more about the human elements of the science, no? Rather than...
But they're still reading in a theology that was not understood. I mean, why is it that the previous Hanabila, including Ibn Qudama and others, are very open about going to the Qawr of the Prophet, speaking to him, asking him to ask Allah for forgiveness? This is Ibn Qudama, right? That's not even occurring to him that there's a problem here in this regard. By the way, I have never done this in my life. Believe it or not, I'm still influenced by Ibn Taymiyyah. I have never once, and I've gone to the Qawr of the Prophet more times than I can count. And I go and I have utmost haybah and respect, and there's awe and there's genuine awe in front of me is the most sacred body to ever have walked the face of this earth. And Allah knows that awe that I have. But to this day, I have never said, Ya Rasulullah, ask Allah for this and that. But I don't have a problem with the one who does. And I know that's going to get into a massive problem. I don't. How can you, Ibn Nawawi, Ibn Qudama, I mean, I can give you 50 scholars who said that. Qurtubi, they all say this, right?
Controversy comes when it's kind of applied beyond that, right? And when you kind of...
So we're opening up the door of what is istighatha and what is tawassul. And you can go over my talk there. But yeah, the controversy comes everywhere. Even with this, I just said the controversy comes. Mm-hmm. So I am no longer emotionally invested in this because I recognize all of these people are coming from different paradigms. I have to choose one in my own personal life. And because I was born and raised, well, not born, but I was born in Jamaat Islami background. My father was one of the founders of Jamaat in America, Maududi and, you know, Haraki. Yeah. My critics say he's gone back to his roots because now he's a Haraki activist, you know what I'm saying? Okay, khair. It is what it is. But my education was in a Salafi paradigm. And I don't have a problem saying, yes, Ibn Taymiyyah's impact on me will probably remain, you know, till the day I die. Mm-hmm. There's no problem with that. But my point is, I don't have a problem with all of these other mainstream normative interpretations that would do things that Ibn Taymiyyah and Ibn Abd al-Wahhab would consider shirk and bid'ah. It's their interpretation. I see from this other group's paradigm, it's not, it goes back to your paradigm and your definitions. Mm-hmm. Ibn Taymiyyah's definition, and then especially Ibn Abd al-Wahhab's definition, are radically different than the definitions of Ibn Hajar. They're radically different than the definitions of the other strands. Once you understand that this really goes back to not simplistic issues, rather deeper issues, neither of them are committing shirk then, man. Just you choose and you preach what you want to in a positive manner and understand that the other group has its ta'wil, and even if they're wrong, Allah will look at their ta'wil. Allah will look at their good intentions in this regard. This is what I'm talking about, having moved beyond these. I am not obsessed with bashing the other groups, even as I myself have not yet celebrated the Mawlid, believe it or not, once. Yeah. I know, it's crazy, isn't it? It's amazing. tell me what your personal experience is, okay? I haven't once spoken to a dead person or wali or whatnot, because I don't personally don't like that. I just don't feel the need to do that. But like I said, I'm not going to criminalize or demonize those strands that view these issues, because I know they're coming from a legacy. They're coming from a trajectory of scholarship, right? But so, you know, so to resurrect those past issues and make them the defining factor goes back to another point that I haven't mentioned yet, but I've given talks about it, the narcissism of small differences. Mm-hmm. Once you understand this psychological concept that human beings are naturally inclined to problematize similarities with similar groups, because they need to define themselves against their closest competitors.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense, the animosity between Ash'aris and Atharis, the animosity between Sufis and Salafis, even though 90% is exactly the same. Once you understand this psychological reality, you just cease to have, I don't want to have animosity in my heart against any believer who loves Allah and His Messenger. Wallahi, I don't want that. I can disagree. I don't want to have hatred. So I've moved beyond these groups. I don't consider them to be the defining factor of who I am. And therefore, when you ask me, which group do you follow? All and none. Mm-hmm. Really, all and none. It doesn't matter to me. I'm much more concerned about defending Islam theologically, politically, socially, in the world that we live in. And therefore, I have that blank slate. I don't care about the slates that have been inherited by my ajdad and forefathers. And I'm worried about what does it mean to be a Muslim in the modern world? Citizenship, liberalism, feminism. These are the issues, you know, balancing Islamic law. And as you know, these are the critics that come here because, again, their paradigm is madhabism. You know, their paradigm is, okay, the law of Ibn Qudama should never be changed. I don't want to say that, but that's effectively what they're doing, okay?
Yeah.
The slate that has been filled by the previous scholarship is the religion of Allah. So when I come along and say, well, no, actually, that's not the religion of Allah. That's their extrapolation. Obviously, one-dimensional minds, oh, he's reforming Islam, destroying Islam. No, bro, you don't know fiqh and usul al-fiqh.
The problem is, you know, some your critics, some of them are just nuts. Right, and they'll just do take bits and pieces and just have motivated by hatred or whatever. But the problem is those drown out the legitimate and constructive criticism and critique
excellent
that you might
nobody
get.
Is perfect.
Yeah,
and there's no doubt that some of what I'm saying and doing is worthy of legitimate criticism. Nobody is perfect.
I mean, I found you too. You people have genuine critique, and they're open to email you. And I mean, I'm against this whole refutation culture in public.
I am somebody who loves.
Yeah.
Positive criticism that comes from adab and sincerity.
Yeah.
And anybody who has interacted with me, inshallah ta'ala, can testify to this. So I'm not perfect, who nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
And we will become stronger when we criticize for the sake of perfection, criticize for the sake of mutual enhancement. That's when we're going to come better. If we're going to criticize to take down, to put down, this
the
is not the way
forward.
Starting
point is different, isn't it? And it always comes across.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, that so some critics might listen to what you just said and say, look, he's belittling Tawheed and Shirk and these types of things because, and I think
that's part their of the definition of Tawheed.
Yeah. But the part of the thing that might be beneficial to from your angle, the way you describe these things, is because I think because of your expertise, your background, maybe it goes above certain people's heads, or you're talking about a very specific thing. They think you're talking about the general, you know, chapter or whatever. Is just to clarify, I think part of the problem is we make it into an aqidah issue, we make it into an issue of theology, of defining groups and sects and so forth, when I think if you look at it from the perspective of just draw a circle around everything, those things that the vast majority agree on, yeah, you'll find people in that circle which happen to identify as different groups based on these man-made categories, Ash'arism, Atharism, Salafism, all that kind of stuff. But they would agree, for example, that, and this might be a better way of maybe phrasing it, that they all agree that, okay, istighatha bil amwat, or, you know, asking a dead person for cure or children or assistance or something like that, don't do it. They won't. Now they'll differ, is it shirk, is it this, is it that, but they, I pretty much, you know, everyone
but that's
would agree.
What I say too.
Yeah, but the way you talk about it is very sometimes academic, and you're talking about the shirk point. Someone might think because he's saying it's not shirk, therefore they'll go to the opposite, they'll assume the opposite, and oh, everything's allowed, go and start, you know, go and asking someone in the grave just because it's not shirk.
No, I have very publicly,
of course,
said
multiple
times I've said it.
But the thing is, because
it is a stepping stone to shirk,
exactly,
but it is not inherently shirk.
But if you describe it as this is. Al-akhbi aqal ma'qil, for example, you know, this is like the common denominator of vast majority.
So, Jayed, I get this point.
Because sometimes I feel that we have a hang-up with trying to prove whether or not it's shirk, or talking about whether or not it's shirk, rather than what's actually important for a Muslim's life, which is, should I be doing something like this or not?
Okay.
I feel it's, so and sometimes I feel that we want to kind of win the argument.
Yeah.
Not yourself, but people who argue about this, they would rather win the argument of is it shirk or is it not shirk, then stop people doing it. I don't know how you feel about this, but I would much rather someone doesn't believe it's shirk and never does it in their life.
I actually said this explicitly.
Yeah?
Yeah. But okay, Dr. Salman Sahab. Itna izzat main aapko de raha hoon, mashallah. Okay, alhamdulillah. Because I genuinely wish to raise the bar of academic acumen and thaqafa and intelligence of the masses that are listening, and I'm not interested in winning points or just smoothing things over, I will push back at you, even though it's going to open up a whole can of worms. I personally believe it is haram. it is bid'ah, it is munkar, it is stepping stone to shirk. And it's only going to be shirk with certain aqa'id. It could be shirk, but it is not in and of itself shirk. That having been said, with that big caveat and disclaimer, the awkward reality is that there are many, many famous, reputable, mainstream Sunni preachers who say that it is mustahab, or at the very least, jais.
In fact, or any random person, or they're talking about the Prophet ﷺ, right?
The Prophet
ﷺ. So, I mean, we can make that exception.
By the way, theologically, you cannot make that exception. Theologically, but do they, you cannot. Like,
just from the, I'm saying, from the perspective of starting off with the
biggest... Let me finish this point here.
Let him land.
So this nice, beautiful save that you want to do, it works in our safe space. And for the viewers who were jumping to critique me, say, okay, khalas, he said that. I'm going to give them ammunition now, because my goal is not them. My goal is the people who are genuinely trying to understand and make sense. I don't want to mention names, but pretty much every single reputable mainstream Western cleric outside of the Salafi paradigm believes it is jaiz or mustahab. That's just a fact.
Yeah.
I've spoken to them.
Yeah.
I accused one of them when in my heyday Salafi days of literally saying you are preaching shirk, but Allah will forgive you because you don't know any better. That's my ignorant 25-year-old idiot self. Literally, you're a kid, your teachers tell you this, you go regurgitate it, right? I literally said to somebody 20 years older than I am, the senior most cleric, and you know, you get who I am.
Yeah.
Literally said to him, and I feel so stupid now, but it was what I felt, this is the haqq, I need to make Iqamatul Hujjah. And I say, look, I need to tell you that you're going to hear this from other people, but I am preaching that you are preaching shirk. And I would say this to your face. I felt, mashallah, validated, okay? And what do you expect him to do? So to be pedantic, accurate here, this nice, simplistic back and forth we had is disconnected from reality. Those guys don't say it's haram.
For...
who cares if it's only for the... You can't just do shirk with one person out of the other.
But that's the thing. The reason why they make an exception about the Prophet ﷺ, you can see there...
So, it's an I know for a fact, I can't mention names here, because, I mean, he has public articles. And I know for a fact, one of the icons of that strand literally has an entire paper justifying it for Anbiya and Awliya in English. Anbiya and Awliya. So... your theory here and your attempt is nice, but my interest really is the long term. Let the cancellations occur. I hope, inshallah, when people listen to this, do your own research. What do you do when the bulk of the ummah is not agreeing with you in this regard? This is the dilemma I faced 15 years ago. When you come to the realization, you're the minority when you say that. And you are, when you don't understand the default of the Shafi'is of Egypt, of the Syrian scholars, of the Yemenis, of the Moroccans, the default is that it is jais. That's why you have to go deeper and understand where they're coming from and understand their definitions of shirk and tawheed is radically different than ours. And then you need to understand where they're coming. As you go deeper and deeper and deeper, and the least that you will come to is, okay, they have a paradigm, may Allah forgive him for it. That's what I'm upon. I'm not saying they're right. I'm not saying they're right. I'm saying I see where they're coming from. And in their worldview, it is not shirk. That's what I come to. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So this is why we have to move beyond the platitudes and the slogans and get to the real nitty gritty. How can you achieve unity with groups that you think are worshipping other than Allah, even if you say, okay, Allah will excuse them for their ignorance, because you're still saying that they're worshipping other than Allah, you know? And by the way, the haram doesn't save you. Why? Because Ibn al-Wahhab clearly, like what literally says, you know, even if you say it's haram, but you don't think it's shirk, you are a mushrik.
Yeah, but I mean...
that's his view, literally. That's his literal view.
So I see that as like kind of on the fringes... but there is,
as is the person
like
himself,
I think even those who would say, for example, okay, it's jaiz, it's mustahab, they in their practice, okay, apart from the more extreme ones, that even that intuitively the average Muslim kind of looks upon and says, well, this is a bit.
I agree. The fitrah finds this.
The fitrah would
100%
kind
agreed.
Of keep the, kind of like yes. a magnet draw them to not going there. And I think it might be kind of sometimes I think it almost talking about it and think of it as a big thing, because even if you're speaking against that mentality, it's kind of accidentally reviving and keeping that thing alive.
Okay.
Whereas maybe reducing the commitment to convincing people about that issue. So I was thinking maybe ibadah. Maybe we've got the notion of ibadah as some kind of simply definable thing wrong.
So I would, if I were to meet one of these shuyukh, I would say to them, my dear brothers in Islam, you know this is a controversial issue. And none of you say it's wajib. None of you say it's wajib. Why don't you just let it be? I would literally advise them, just get out of this controversy, because you provoke the other side. I know the other side's acting rash and foolish as well, but by you constantly doing this, you're going to provoke the other side.
Why don't they just polarize.
Yeah, they polarize. Yeah. So I would definitely advise them this as well. Like, don't get involved in controversial stuff. But when all is said and done, I am not interested in categorizing these other Muslims as being the worst of mankind.
Of course.
I can cooperate with them for other needs and goods.
Not just that, but you can feel that they are brothers.
They are, they are
not
our
just
brothers.
Like cooperation for
so
the sake of
this, that cannot happen if I have this cognitive dissonance, and it didn't happen because I know myself. When I was on the old school paradigm, you're smiling at them, but in your heart there's this ache. You're sitting and eating with them, but they're not really my full brethren. You can't help it because that's the way you feel. Yeah. And now, that's not the case, because I genuinely view all of these strands. Yes, Salafis included, they're still my brethren. Alhamdulillah, I'm not anti-Salafi, I just moved on. They are all, that doesn't mean all Muslims are exactly the same. I've said this as well. There are red lines. To believe in a prophet out of the Prophet is clearly a red line. Yeah. To believe in a God other than Allah, which no Muslim actually does, is clearly a red line. To abandon worship of Allah, which one or two of the extreme Ismaili groups have done. There is no ta'abbud, there is no salah, there is no zakah. There is no, when you're not even worshipping, there is no la ilaha illallah, there is no worship. No, that means you've crossed the red line over there, right? So there are red lines. But within these red lines, all of these movements are Muslim. Now, some are better and closer. And without a doubt, Sunnism, alhamdulillah, respects the Sahaba. And that is definitely a positive thing to do. I don't agree with the other school that disrespects, but they're not kafirs for it. Without a doubt, you know, I'll still say this for the record, the Athari creed overall, it's the more sensible one because it's not going from John of Damascus' division of the attributes, but still, it's a trivial difference. So my point, though, is these differences should not be to the point of dividing us such that we cannot come together for the greater good. This is the key point. And for the record, before we finish off as well, we didn't talk about the details of why I say it's not shirk and it's only haram and whatnot. For that, you can listen to my 3-hour lecture on the Najdi Da'wah, where I go into in a lot of detail. Please listen to it. Take notes if you need to, but I go into it and I explain why I hold these views. So that's explaining that, inshallah.
Did you have something on that? I've got another.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask, Sheikh, you know, you're talking about this dissonance, and there's one thing within the Muslims, but actually I think for a lot of Muslims, especially for us growing up, kind of those mid-40s, right, is with the,
or
with
30s.
The kuffar as well. 30s. Even with the non-Muslims.
Yes, another issue. The wala and bara versions we were taught. This was one of the
first
things.
How many fights do you want to pick today?
No, no, no. But this is like, it's a natural concept. If you're talking about dissonance, a lot of people, they've kind of reconciled with other Muslims, but with non-Muslims, there's still that thing.
Yeah, this is a topic I need to talk about in more academic detail. I was planning to give a library chat about this because this is another massive problem the average Muslim has. Yeah. The misunderstanding of wala and bara. Again, to be academic, may Allah protect me, but this is the truth. I mean, it is the academic truth. The understanding of wala and bara that was taught by Ibn Abdul Wahhab was unprecedented to Islamic history. Ibn Taymiyyah didn't teach it. Ghazali didn't teach it. Tahawi doesn't have that type of understanding. The Ibn Abdul Wahhab understanding of wala and bara became a politicized takfir.
Yeah.
If you don't agree with me and you side with my political enemy, you are a kafir in the eyes of Allah. That's what he taught, and that's what he did. And he fought, and he killed, based upon that. Again, well known, read the books. That understanding of wala and bara before Ibn Abdul Wahhab is more of an adab than fiqh and aqidah. I.e., what do I mean by this? You should have a generic love for the Muslims. And anybody who wants to harm Islam, you can't like that person. This is a more of an adab. You don't politicize it, because politicizing it means you are going to define who is a good and a bad Muslim and who is on the side of this and the side of that. That only occurs in the Battle of Badr.
There are rules though, Sheikh, isn't it? Called like jizya, for example. So there is some politicization if Islam
That's
is...
That's not wala and bara.
No, no, okay.
That's not wala and bara. Wala and bara comes into the reality of the last 20 years of all that's taking place in our nation states. Taking sides means you're a kafir? Well, but that's exactly what wala and bara would entail. Taking sides means you're... So this is the whole issue here, right? So yeah. This understanding needs to be deconstructed academically. I haven't done it yet. Others have done it. I need to have a big library chat about the reality of wala and bara, the misunderstanding that has come from Ibn al-Wahhab's movement, and then after that from the modern manifestations, you know, al-Maqdisi and others, how they have resurrected that misunderstanding. Ironically, I find this interesting for the academically inclined. SubhanAllah, so interesting, right? This notion is purely coming from one strand of Islam. But because of interaction, it has trickled over into other understandings. You hear Deobandi ulama talking about wala and bara. It's not a part of the Deobandi tradition at all. You know, it's like interesting how they've taken these types of things and you know, when was it when your queen died, right? And something happened. I forgot what, like some child's in the masjid.
I want to say, God save the king.
Oh yeah, the central masjid. There
listen,
was.
I'm not taking sides here, but nobody became a kafir. Let me just put it that way, okay? I mean, the whole brouhaha and controversy, I forgot the details, so I should be careful here. But I was just laughing, like, seriously, guys? I mean, you can say it's not appropriate, you can say kada wa kada, but accusations of kufr, accusations of ridda, bro, I mean, ridda, I mean, a'udhu billah.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone was taking seriously who was...
online, they were there, like, there was... I mean,
you're going to get that kind of mentality.
It's like this extremism that has happened, that if you merely show any type of, you know, you can say acting foolish in this regard, I get it, totally get it, but there is no theology here in this regard, you know, and a lot of us that, it is what it is, man. So
your expertise, your background is the evolution, the history of ideas and sects and so forth. What would you...
Sects. Careful how you pronounce that.
Although you're also... I had an expert on the other one.
Mashallah, mashallah. Tilka ummatun qad khalat.
My question is, what do you think historians later on would say about today? What and how will they describe Muslim sects and groups and so forth today and going forward?
So I think we are seeing a new phase of interest and a new revival of questions and epistemologies because of the circumstances we find ourselves in. And later historians, without a doubt, will have a lot to say about our times. We are one of the first generations, especially in the West, that has to tackle sectarianism in a very academic way. You don't find ulama in Pakistan or in Timbuktu or in Egypt tackling sectarianism head on.
Yeah.
Because there's no need to. It's the Muslims of England and America that are actually talking and producing academic papers. Sheikh Haytham has produced something. I have multiple talks about sectarianism, right? How we deal with this difference of opinion. Believe it or not, we're actually producing a thought that is effective for the rest of the world. We're producing it in the Western world. Why? Because we have been forced by circumstance to think and to act in ways people outside of us don't have to do. The same applies for what I'm doing. If I hadn't been forced to think along the lines I'm being, I wouldn't have been thinking along these lines. I'd just be a card-carrying, you know, Taymiyan all the way through. But life and circumstances teach you what books do not teach you. And to see with your own eyes this reality of, okay, this isn't the religion of Allah to tell people the sifat are like this and tawheed is like this and whatnot. They're all tawheed. They're all people of tawheed. My version of tawheed is but one version. All of these people are loving Allah and His Messenger. None of them in their minds, I have to go back to it, none of them is equating the Prophet with Allah. That's the best definition of tawheed.
Knowing what you know now about what happened in the 2nd century, 3rd century, and how later it was, it took on a kind of life of its own, these groups, these
That's
fault
not
going to
happen, because the chart has already been filled.
But do you think...
That's not going to happen.
Do you
no
think
new
there'll
sects,
be
no new
different
movies.
Sects from different angles?
No, I don't think so. Not really. There will be fringe movements, but you cannot reinvent that wheel because those are the original dominoes. Those, they have a certain privilege, a historical privilege, not a theological privilege.
That might be because of the subject they're talking about. What about, for example, along the lines of secularism or liberalism? The
modern we're already issues having that these discussions. We don't call them sects. We don't call them schisms.
Groups or parties, identities.
You really want to get controversial. Let's go for it. Yeah. You interviewed Dr. Haytham al-Haddad 2 weeks ago about secular mind, right? I heard that interview.
Actually, it was done ages ago, but
really?
Just published
it. Okay, I heard it 2 weeks ago. Okay, and I interviewed Dr. Akram Nadwi because these are public. I'll mention names. Okay, and I interviewed Dr. Hatem Al-Hajj about these issues, and my views are also known. Okay, us four, I mentioned by name because they're all public.
Yeah,
our views are very close when it comes to Muslims living in modern times under secular lands. Very close. We, and especially me, because I don't know why, just me, but we are extremely criticized by many other strands. We're actually called sellouts, deviants, CIA agents, RAND agents, reformers, whatnot. You all know this, right? This is an example of a modern theological battle taking place in front of your eyes. It's literally a new battle taking place. Mm-hmm. Because we are attempting to navigate living in the lands that we live in a very different way than our
critics. Are you called any of that by people with any kudos, or like are you equating like social media comments with
their social media?
Are you misunderstood, Sheikh, or is it that you're
is that you are a CIA agent?
No.
Where's my paycheck, man?
Is it genuinely that you're bringing something different, or people are misunderstanding you? Are they really understanding the points that you're making?
Both are there. I am. Look at what I just said about aqidah.
Yeah.
Very few people are this blunt about saying I don't care about the sifat controversy.
I don't know. I think
you think there are people saying this?
In my experience,
okay,
it doesn't sound that outlandish. It sounds like it feels like you're bringing your background as
could be then. Okay,
you
could
know,
be.
This
I
is
hope
a
so.
Huge schism, and this is. You know, people are going to cancel me and people are going to...
Well, they are,
me.
But I'm saying...
I feel my anecdotal experiences, that's more like social media kind of banter and stuff, less so the average Molana in my masjid. You know, even the Deobandi Molana in my masjid, even if you push cups to shove, he'll probably agree with most of the stuff you said. Likewise, you know, the
I
the
think my experiences with clerics is different than yours then.
Yeah.
Clerics that are trained.
Maybe you rub them up differently.
Cleric could be.
Because you know,
clerics that are trained.
With peers that you get a bit
that are trained in their traditions generally don't appreciate this sentiment.
And I
like
suppose
I said,
an expert,
they
someone
don't
who
mind
tra- someone
level
who's
two. And level two is, okay, I'm right, you're wrong, live but we're still, live. Let's live and let live. Mm. They don't mind that. That, if you're talking about that, I agree with you. I'm not, level two is fine and I'm happy if you get there. But for the intellectuals, we need to get a level three.
But you're within all this, I think part of what it is you see when you're shining a light on, and I don't want to say criticizing because I don't think it's criticism, but you're shining a light on what many people's lives, entire scholarship has been built upon. Then it's like you're taking away the foundations. And
what's the goal of doing that?
For them to...
No, for me. What is the goal?
No, there isn't a... But I don't think you are, Sheikh. This is what I'm saying. Well, see, what you may think is implied, that actually you're building upon, or it's how you've understood the tradition and you're bringing it into how it's manifested today. It's very different to saying, I disagree with the tradition. And sometimes it comes out as if you are pushing yourself away from the tradition. Just and it's just how people understand what you're saying.
So the tradition is how we got here. We wouldn't be here without the tradition.
Yeah.
So... where there's no need to rethink or change, we should stick to the tradition, without a doubt. But where circumstances force us, where we find the tradition is simply not working, then let us go back and see, is the tradition itself the religion of Allah, or is it a development from the religion? So the default, and this is where I say I'm different from the modernists and progressives, because I don't like their usul. The default is we stick to the tradition.
Yeah.
And we admire the tradition, with the recognition that the tradition is a man-made product.
Yes.
But there are going to be specific issues that are going to challenge us. and life will be almost impossible or very difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
Where that happens, let us, not me, groups of people, senior to me, elder than me, come together and then discuss those particular issues and see, can we find a way that respects the religion of Allah, because we can never compromise. There is no reformation in the deen of Allah. But the interpretations of men, without a doubt, that's interpretations of men. So who's going to make that distinction? Qualified people. I am the least of them, but perhaps inshallah can sit in the room with them. And yeah, I can do that. So like I said, listen to the, I liked the interview with Dr. Haytham. I liked the interview with, you had it with another person as well. And then I give two interviews with Dr. Akram. Tom as well, mashallah, yeah, good. And yeah, Dr. No, before I forgot, Dr. Akram as well, and Dr. Hatim Al-Hajj. I asked the viewers that are watching, forget me, go listen to these other three guys. Sheikh Haytham Al-Haddad, Dr. Akram Nadawi, Dr. Hatim Al-Hajj. They're all older than me in age. They're all wiser than me in experience. They're all more knowledgeable than me. And all of them are saying pretty much what I am saying, is that, yes, theory is great, but right now we're living under a nation state. Right now we have to carve a way out, understanding that it might have to rethink through some of the simplistic notions we had in the past. This is not a rejection of the religion of Allah. Mm-hmm. It is actually the proper manifestation of how it should be applied given our context.
But also within that, I think we can say, Sheikh, the, have the humility to say that, and some mistakes may be made.
Of course, but it's better,
a journey, right?
Of course, yeah, but it's better than hiding your head in the sand.
Exactly.
That's not going to get you anywhere.
Yeah.
Which is what traditionalism does.
Yeah.
It's better than saying that we cannot change anything because the human product that we have inherited is the religion of Allah. No, that's not correct. Mm-hmm. So yes, all of us are going to make some mistakes, all of us. But we hope, inshallah, that people will come and help us correct the mistakes and make a bigger and better product for the mm-hmm. future, mm-hmm. rather than pull people down for the small mistakes that are made.
So you mentioned like Muslims vis-a-vis the secular nation state, the secularism today, that could be one of the kind of fault lines that emerge or historians might look back at. I'm mentioning these so we can kind of preempt it and maybe lay the foundations for being careful not to let these kind of schisms become too extreme and turn
I don't think they're going to create in the they're going to result in the creation of actual sectarian lines, but they're going to be trends.
Mm-hmm. Because I mean, maybe the early,
I don't see this happening. But you never
Kalam
know. You never
arguers
know.
Against it. Could be. Didn't you never know that about.
But yeah, so sectarian. I mean, so you're going to find these trends mm-hmm. when it comes to this issue. Obviously, another major elephant in the room is the issue of gender wars taking place right now about the role of men and women. And as you know, this is one of the biggest, hottest topics online. You know, how should men and women? What does it mean to be a Muslim man in our times? And again, my views are somewhere along the spectrum, and you got people to the right of me, to people left of me. So it is what it is, you know. Mm-hmm. Another is going to be political participation, which is a very, very awkward. And we haven't solved this problem. We have not solved this problem.
We have.
Yeah. You definitely have not. 100% you have not. We have because Muslim we have a Muslim mayor and a Muslim this and okay, yeah, Muslim prime minister.
Actually,
okay,
forget alhamdulillah. I'm worried about these 20 mile an hour zones.
Alhamdulillah. 20 miles an hour. The American viewership has no idea what you're talking about. But the biggest criticism Salman Bhai has of his mayor is that he has lowered the speed limit to 20 miles an hour. And Salman Bhai is so angry.
I could overlook
this. So angry that he's going to cancel the mayor.
Zakalakh Sheikh, let's bring wrap it up then, inshallah. It's been a marathon one. Zakalakh khairan, Dr. Sheikh Yasir.
Always a pleasure, mine. Alhamdulillah. Zakalakh khairan
for joining us, and Zakalakh khairan for you at home. I'm also Omar as well for sorting out the offices. All Zakalakh khairan. Thanks for watching, tuning in. Let us know in the comments. You know, if you agree, disagree, if you want to refute anyone here.
Anyone here.
فيا ذلي ويا خجلي إذا ما قال لي ربي أما استحييته تعصيني ولا تخشى من العتب وتخفي الذنب عن خلقي وتأبى في الهوى قربي فتب مما جنيت عسى تعود إلى رضا